Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you for listening this morning. You can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan of the show. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys on Facebook. And I would love to hear from you. You can send me an email. My email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. Again, that's SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I encourage you to follow me or become a fan, because I give a lot of things away, tickets, books, CDs, dinners. So you really want to become a fan or follow on Twitter. But I want to thank you. We're heading towards 74,000 downloads of the show, and I could not have done that without your support, your sharing with friends and family. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. Well, this morning, a beautiful, talented, just skillful writer, Martha Southgate. She has four novels. Her newest novel is The Taste of Salt, and that's what we're going to talk about today. If you have a question, you can call in 646-929-0368. Also, some of her other books, That Girl from the Left won the Best Novel of the Year Award from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. Also, her other novel you might be familiar with, The Fall of Rome, received the 2003 Alex Award from the American Library Association and was named one of the best novels of 2002 by Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post. So I want to welcome Martha. Good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Well, good morning. I'm glad to be here, Joy.
I just want to read a little bit from your book, one of the more sensuous moments, I will say, of the book. But I want to read it out for the audience. Again, if you're just listening, I'm talking with Martha Southgate about her latest book, The Taste of Salt. Once we were inside, we stood still for a minute, trying to act as though nothing was happening. Then he slid his arm around my waist. There was a lot of quiet breathing and the sound of the ocean outside. Words had been removed from my mind. The silence got larger. I felt like I might die inside it, that we might stand there, him embracing me, until the end of the world, and I would never say another word. I was thinking that until he said, "Oh, Christ, Josie, come on." His voice was hoarse and soft. I turned to face him. He put his hand under my chin gently. "Let me look at you," he said. "Let me look at you." I didn't turn away or close my eyes. He kept gazing at me, so long that I thought that might be all he wanted. He then pulled my head toward him, and we started kissing. After a while, he said it again, "Let me look at you." I knew what he meant. I stood up, and I took a few steps away from him. I took off my shorts and then my shirt with a lot of awkward wriggles and twists, like I was in my bedroom at home, and I wasn't embarrassed. And he said, "My God, you are so beautiful." He paused, and then he reached out and pulled me toward him, and we started kissing again, kissing everywhere. He tasted of salt. He smelled of the sun. I thought it might never end.
Woo!
Wow. Okay, it's a little hot in here. It's a little hot. I need to get the fan on. So that's just a glimpse. That's just a glimpse of her wonderful writing. So
can I tell you, I never hear it read aloud by other people. That was wild. So thank you.
Okay, that's and you never hear your reading. So how does that make you feel, hearing other people read your work?
You know, sort of funny. I mean, in a good way, that is pretty sexy. I will take credit for that, but it's a little startling, actually, because, you know, I do readings. I read it out loud to people, and I haven't been fortunate enough to have this be an audio book. I hope it will be. But it's really interesting to sort of hear what you've done, not in the voice in your head. I like that. But it's a little startling. It really is. And also,
yeah.
I have to say, I very rarely read that part publicly myself, because I feel a little, it's just hard for me to read that out loud. You know what I mean?
Not that embarrassed.
But, and also, it doesn't advance the story in a way. You know, if you haven't read the book, et cetera, it's just, I try to read stuff that's going to kind of pull people into the story. I generally read from the beginning. So,
yeah.
When I'm doing public
readings. Yeah, I just thought that was interesting because of the last line about the tea tasted of salt. So
mm-hmm.
I connected it
mm-hmm.
with the title of your book.
Yeah.
But let me just start at the beginning with you for people who may not be familiar. Let's just talk a little bit about, you're from Cleveland. The book takes place in Cleveland. What got you drawn into writing books? What was your catalyst for writing books?
Well, I've been writing for a long time now. As you said, this is my fourth novel, and I was a journalist before. I worked at Essence for a number of years and at the New York Daily News as an entertainment reporter. And I was always a really big reader. I read a lot from my very earliest days. And, I wrote for school. I wrote a little, but I didn't start aspiring to write fiction until I was in my mid-20s or so. And then really
mm-hmm.
I took some classes and, you know, would start things and not finish them, start things and not finish them. And finally I started something that over a number of years grew into Another Way to Dance that I finished, that I got interested in. I went on to get an MFA in creative writing, which is very much where I learned how to write a novel and began to shape it. And so that's basically how I got started writing books. Main thing, I think, especially at the beginning, is you, the writer, have to be interested in knowing how your story's going to end and in learning how to tell it to the best of your ability. And so that
mm-hmm.
really didn't catch for me till I was in my 20s and early 30s. But it's
so
important.
Who are some of your... It's important to read and as an author. Who are some of your,
mm-hmm.
I guess, inspirations as writer? Who are some of your inspirational writers?
I'd say, early Toni Morrison. I still remember when I read The Bluest Eye. It was in my college
mm-hmm.
dorm, and I remember just, like, dropping the book and being like, oh, my God, that's the best book I've ever written. You know, it was, like, mind-boggling. And so certainly that, The Bluest Eye and Sula and Song of Solomon in particular have all been really important to me, although my writing is nothing like hers. Some James Baldwin, particularly the story called Sonny's Blues,
mm-hmm.
a children's book called Harriet the Spy by Louise
Fitzhugh, oh, yeah.
was an extremely early influence, but a really key one. You know, sometimes those books what you read when you're kids, your kid can really sink in forever. And more contemporary stuff that's been important to me is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow, The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. Those are all writers whose work I really admire and has been really important to me. Also,
yeah,
Smiley as well.
Song of Solomon, I remember, I've read that. I mean, I think the book is yellow so many times,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But let me read
mm-hmm.
a little bit from the beginning. I want to read and get to the meat of your storyline here.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read
mm-hmm.
a little from the beginning. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with author Martha Southgate about her newest book, The Taste of Salt. You can call in 646-929-0368. The greatest thing about the job was getting to be in the water nearly every day. My favorite part was after I had all my dive equipment on, rolling in backward and letting the water close over my head, the air coming into me from the oxygen tank on my back so that I was buoyed up and breathing even though there was water all around me. I would cut through it and the fish would swim up and hover around me like jewel-colored birds or butterflies over a field. I loved breathing underwater but still being safe, held, protected. I love the weightlessness. I never felt that the rest of the time. Life weighs a ton. That's why I love the water. Nothing weighs anything there. So let's just talk about this character, your main character. She's really into the water. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about her?
Well, her name's Josie Henderson, and she's a marine biologist. And I always cite her job when I'm describing the character because her job is so important to her. She is a very good scientist in a field where there aren't too many African-American women. And she really, the way she got into, as she says, this work is through her love of swimming, of just water as a kind of protective environment. And so it ends up becoming a big metaphor for her throughout the book. And as I think you mentioned, part of her struggle in the book and part of why she says, life weighs a ton is she's some extent uses her work as a hideout from some of her problems on dry land. She dealing with two generations of alcoholism in her family and some tensions within her marriage. And, you know, her work provides something of a refuge from that. But ultimately she finds, you know, you can't really live underwater, and she finds you can't hide out from that stuff forever.
But
it's also important to have a passion, and she definitely has that. And I wanted to include that as well.
Well, some of the things you spoke about earlier, just about yourself, about the love of reading, you bring that throughout this novel. And in your other books, you mentioned so many other writers and talking about the parents reading to her and her brother. I myself grew up in a household with tons of books. I mean, like, we had a library, literally. Like, there was a room, and there was, like, bookshelves all around. And now when my daughter grows up, you know, the importance of reading, you know, I think these kids, what do you think about, like, kids online and gaming and, you know, listening to music but not reading? I mean, kids get out of school, they can't even read.
Well, you know, it's bad. What else am I going to say? It's really difficult these days. I have two kids, and I'll be utterly candid. Neither of them read as much as I did, and I wish they both read more. It's very hard to fight against the number of screens, number of really interesting screens that you're presented with. I mean, the one, like, one small or one change I've noticed, if you leave, even if you leave the internet out of it, is these days, even just on cable, there is always something a kid might find interesting. Where it used to be your show was on, and then it was the news. You know, you didn't have your shows on all the time. So
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, you know, when my daughter was of that age, she's older now, but when she was into Nickelodeon stuff, she could turn on iCarly at any moment of the day or night. And you know, we restricted how many moments she could have like that, but it was always available. So I think it's hard for parents these days. That's the reason I bring that up, because I'm a writer and I struggle with it with my kids. I think it's important to hold the line as much as you can, especially read to them when they're little and encourage reading as a habit. You know, with some kids, you're going to make limited headway, but keep trying. My kids are in high school now, and I actually just decided I'm going to choose with each of them a book that we'll read maybe for 10 minutes a night. I'm going to let them pick the book. If they don't pick one, I'll pick it. And just, you know, just a tiny bit, read to them. Because he stopped that as I get older. But I'm going to give that a try. I'm not preaching because I haven't done it yet. but I'm going to try it. I'm hopeful it'll work. And we'll keep just a foot in. It's not like they don't read in school. I mean, they both go to good schools. They do read. But it's hard to get kids.
I think our lives are packed. Our lives are packed these days with more things and stuff. But let's bring up this main issue. I want to read a little bit. This is from the middle part of the book, dealing with her brother, and that this is why she likes to be in the water and away from the world, and a lot has to do with her brother and her father. My name is Edmund, but everybody calls me Tick. I'm an alcoholic. I've been in and out of these meetings too many times to count. I know these damn steps by heart. I just can't live them. Well, I don't have the willingness yet. Don't know how I'm going to get it. I'm sitting here, Sharon, because I'm trying again. It's been 3 months since I had a drink. I've been drinking since I was 15. Now, this is something I underlined in here, that he was drinking since he was 15. And I just want to tell the general public, I did a show on alcoholism. I actually featured it right above this show. So if you're at the website, you'll see and you can read that with the doctor who focuses on helping alcoholism. But a lot of people start very young, as a teenager, with alcoholism. And unfortunately, in Martha's story, the young man's father was also alcoholic. So that makes it 10 times worse. If you have a parent or a guardian or caregiver who's alcoholic, then you may or may not. Now, all children of alcoholics do not become alcoholics, but the chances are higher, and you may have other addiction issues. So why alcoholism? Why did you choose that as the focus here?
Well, you know, I don't really write from a lesson I want to impart or a issue I want to tackle, but sometimes when I'm done with the book, I realize, oh, there's an issue in here. And so it was with this. I really started with Josie, and then I got interested in her character and why she made certain choices, and then I, you know, she is who she is, but also everyone's formed by their families. And so as I was writing, I started thinking about her family and then developed these characters who have this particular issue. I would say alcoholism, you know, like so many of us, I have had experience with that in my family going back a few generations, you know, many, many. It's interesting. It's something, you know, all human families have had to deal with to one extent. Not all, but, you know, it's across all cultures. But there hasn't been, to my knowledge, much writing or either fiction or nonfiction about it by African-American writers. So when I was done with this, I thought, oh, you know, I guess that it's something that has touched lives of my relatives and my life through various relatives. And I know it touches a lot of other people. So I was glad to have wrestled with it. But I didn't sit down thinking, I want to write a book about alcoholism.
Yeah.
But it's something that it emerged as I wrote.
Well, I think you have a lot of other stories, and that's part of the reason I read the more sensuous part, just to show, mm-hmm. show the other side. But mm-hmm. just to let the audience know that even that one moment for the character is actually a form of escape for her, and she has her own demons that, you know, she's dealing with.
Yeah.
One of the other things you bring up, and this is related to addictions of all types, the issue of lying and shame
mm-hmm.
is brought out throughout the book. And you mentioned earlier that you like Harriet the Spy book, and you kind of bring that up in the story. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's as a parent, you can't tell your children everything. You know,
no.
I mean, you know, so the parent is protecting the child sometimes when they're lying. I mean, you're a parent. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but as a parent, I mean, you can't tell your kids everything.
Mm-hmm.
When do you decide to break the bad news to a child? You know, when it first happens, is it a month later or a year later? You know,
well,
everybody has a different style, but.
You know, I think it depends on the situation. I mean, to my mind, some of the choices, and this is common in alcoholic families, often there's sort of a big lie that, you know, mom or dad's okay, or that, you know, we have to cover for them, and that's what the lingo calls enabling. And that's
mm-hmm.
a bad lie. You know, it's not going to work out for long because they have this major problem that if you keep covering for them or lying to yourself or your family about it, yeah, as difficult mm-hmm. as it is, it only is going to get worse. That said, one of the reasons I found Harriet the Spy so sort of formative was there's I won't tell too many details, but at one point a major character is told by an adult that sometimes you do have to lie, that sometimes you do have to obfuscate the truth. And I remember reading that as a kid and thinking, you know, she's on to something. Because I think adults know, you know, sometimes gray areas are where we live. Sometimes absolute honesty in all things is not the best way. I'm not proponing that, you know, touting that as the way to go in every single area of your life. And certainly, as I said, in terms of alcoholism, you know, lying about it as the mother sometimes does to Josie, trying to hide what's actually going on, that's always going to be a problem. But, you know, I'm really interested as a fiction writer in gray areas, and that's part of, you know, what I was wrestling with.
Definitely.
Too.
Yeah. I want to mention to the audience the National Drug and Alcohol Treatment referral hotline number is 1-800-662-HELP. Again, 1-800-662-HELP, which is 1-800-662-4357. So if you have a question
mm-hmm.
or you're looking for a program in your area, please call that number
mm-hmm.
and reach
mm-hmm.
out and get help for yourself or others. One of the issues that I've mentioned in the other show dealing with alcohol addiction was the life of the caregiver. And the life of the mother in the story, I mean, she, you know, is just weighed with two individuals that she loves and cares for. And, you know, her trying to set boundaries as
mm-hmm.
a caregiver of somebody who has an addiction, that's a very hard thing, especially if you love
mm-hmm.
somebody, to set
yeah.
a boundary,
yeah.
you know?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what 12-step groups, that's one of the many things they're all about. You know, because as many of your listeners may know, there's the groups for the person with the addiction, but there's also Al-Anon or whatever, Anon, that's there for the person that's, you know, loves or is related to or the person with the addiction. And there's certain things that such a person has to learn to do. And some of it is
mm-hmm.
letting go, you know, basically
yeah.
letting them go down, which is very, very hard to do. You know, letting them go down lovingly, but you can't stop them. And that's a really hard thing to get your mind around. So, yeah,
there's a big pain in that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big
mm-hmm.
pain in that. And one of the,
yeah.
you read the poem, you have a poem in there from Langston Hughes about the, you know, wave of sorrow. And, you
mm-hmm.
know, is a wave, because it comes and goes, because a person can be clean for a short period and then slip, or they can even can be clean for a long period, you know, several years,
yeah.
and then one day, boom, out of nowhere, they're back into their addiction, whatever it is, it's alcohol,
yeah,
or cocaine,
yeah.
or,
no,
you know, sexual
yep.
addiction or whatever, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see
yeah.
it as a family story about a family affected by addiction, an addiction story about a family. I think, yeah, it, you know, it's obviously a huge challenge if you have it in your family. It also can be life-threatening, you know. You're not talking about a small problem. And I think that, you know, for the caregiver managing it, and as you said, managing those waves is, you know, a lifelong process and a very, very difficult one.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, some of the other things you bring up in the book, besides the addiction, interracial relationships. I want
mm-hmm.
to read a little bit. This is from the beginning. The main
mm-hmm.
character is married to a white man. She's black and
mm-hmm.
he's white. Daniel, my husband, is white. I don't know why I announce it, except that it's the first thing you notice, especially around here, the two of us. People don't disapprove, but they do notice. Well, here's the other reason I say it, because I noticed it myself. I've been with other white guys, not that many black guys, to tell the truth, just one in grad school. It didn't work out for a lot of reasons. But sometimes I wonder what it would be would have been like to make a life with someone who looked more like me, maybe had lived more like me. I know race isn't the way to make these decisions, but in my secret heart sometimes I just wish Daniel knew certain things, certain sounds, certain feelings in a way that he just can't. That was very, I thought, very brave of you for the character to say that, you know, about her own husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if other people who are in interracial relationships have that feeling that I just wish the person was this. I love them. They're great. You know, they have my back and so on and so forth. To the end, I'll die for them. But that one, you know, difference, you know, I just
yeah.
wish they had this, you know.
Well.
Why did you put it interracial? What was the choice? Was that a conscious choice, or just came about as you were writing?
Yeah, it was conscious. This book is not strictly autobiographical, but I'd be lying if I said I never dated a white guy, and I'm married to one now. And I think anyone, you know, in such a relationship, sooner or later you're going to run into either internally and probably externally issues of race, because race in America is a really big thing. And some of it, you know, I think does sometimes have to do with culture. And culture does not have to be a dividing thing, but it's something that comes up. I think it can be even more pronounced and perhaps easier to talk about when you're dealing with someone from a truly, quote-unquote, foreign culture, like a Chinese person and a white person, where there's a different language and many, many different, you know,
cultural
things
aspects,
going on.
Yeah, mm-hmm,
yeah
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm sure there's moments where I can't believe there would be moments where you're like, wow, I wish he spoke Chinese. or grew up eating the same things I ate or whatever. I would also say, though, that this is interesting to observe my own kids. I think some of this may be breaking down, at least on the pop culture level, because pop culture is much more, there's way more class divisions, but I feel like a lot of pop
mm-hmm.
culture is much more homogenized. Like, everyone loves Beyonce, you know? White,
yeah.
black, Puerto
well,
Rican.
Well, Ellis Coase, journalist Ellis Coase was on his show talking about his
yeah.
book, The End of Anger, and he broke it down
mm-hmm.
in generations about their perception
yeah.
of race and
yeah.
how the younger generation, there's more fluidity back and forth,
yeah.
and there's less fear to some degree. Not that they don't totally ignore it, but it's just, it's not as omnipresent in their lives.
I can see it with my kids. It does not mean the same thing. And it's actually progress, even though it sometimes feels a little weird to those who are older.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I
mm-hmm.
just saw it. This is somewhat off topic, but when Obama was elected, my mother's 80, and you know, she almost died. She's like, can this be happening? And I was sort of like stunned. If you'd asked me even a year before, I would have said, no way. My kids were like,
right.
that's cool. You know, they were pleased, and they understood it as a historically significant moment, but they didn't find it absolutely, completely inconceivable. And that makes
yeah.
a big difference, you know?
Well, that's definitely, I think it's a great move toward some peace in the world that the younger generation, but at the same time, one of the things I don't like is when people say, I don't see your color. I don't like that. I think you need to see my color, and every black person is not the same. Every black person grew up differently, has different backgrounds. So you have to take the person as an individual, yet and still, when I do walk outside and certain incidents happen, I am faced with my blackness, I feel.
Oh,
I don't wake
absolutely.
Up in the morning, you know, but certain things make me, like, draw me, okay, that's what happened.
Yeah.
All right, okay, because I'm, you know.
Of course. So. I mean, and that's what Josie's wrestling with. I mean, there's even an incident in there that I did based on, I'm not a scientist, but this was an anecdote I read about where she gets mistaken for the health at a scientific conference. So, of course, I am in no way saying, even in that comment I just made, that race doesn't matter and my kids are aware of their race. But, I think it matters. But I would also say at the same time, this is another gray area, that things have changed. You know, I think both things are true.
Definitely. Well, let me tell the audience about your website. You have a website, MarthaSouthgate.com. Also, you're on Twitter, M-E. Southgate, if you want to follow her on Twitter, and she's also on Facebook. So I'll put those in the chat room, and I'll tweet them out again. But, again, you can check out her website, MarthaSouthgate.com, to learn more about her other books. She has three other novels, so you want to check those out. And just real quickly, one of the issues you bring up, we only have 2 minutes left, motherhood, having babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a
mm-hmm.
lot of times in books, the woman wants to have a baby, she wants to get married. This character is pulling away, wants to not have a baby. She has attachment issues, in a sense. Where did that come from, that idea to bring that in about not wanting to have a baby, where every other woman in stories wants to have a baby, you know?
Right. Well, I love my children enormously, and I think motherhood's a great thing, and it drives me insane in the culture right now how if you don't want to have a kid, if a woman just doesn't want to have children, there's, like, something wrong with her, she's going to come around or something like that. Not everyone can have kids. Not everyone wants to have kids. And, you know, I feel there is this enormous push to do it, whether and if you don't do it,
want
there's
something
a little bit wrong with you. And that, it drives me crazy, just as a stance. It's something I really admire about the woman who won't eat, pray, love, who doesn't have kids.
Oh, yeah.
Very open, like, I don't want any kids, and I'm a great aunt. And I say, so that's kind of where that came from. I wasn't trying to be really political, but something I feel strongly about. Not everyone wants to have kids. Not everyone should. You know?
No, everyone should not have kids. I will underline
it. I was going to say, I mean, as we know, by the way some poor children suffer, either physically or emotionally, a lot of people who shouldn't have kids have had them. So
yes, because we have to deal
to.
With them as adults. please, because then we have to deal with the crazy people as adults.
I agree with you on that.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show this morning, Martha. Really, I will tell you, you guys are going to need some tissue throughout the book, so just put a little box of tissue there. Just kind of sneaks up on you. And I was like, oh, crap, she got me. Oh, God. You know? So,
thank you.
I'm going to be giving copies of her book, so you want to follow me on Twitter, @JoyKeys, and you want to become a fan on Facebook. Thank you so much, Martha, for coming on. I wish you much success with this book, and please stay in touch and come back when you write another novel in the future.
I will. Thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you. Have a lovely Saturday.
Okay, you too. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with author Martha Southgate, her latest book, The Taste of Salt. You want to win a copy, you can follow me @JoyKeys on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I want to encourage you to check out her website, MarthaSouthgate.com. She has three other novels, wonderful stories. You will be entranced. You will be sucked in. You're going to need a box of tissue. You might change your career, so on and so forth. So you want to check her out. But, again, I'll be giving away a free copy. So you want to follow on Twitter, @JoyKeys. You want to become a fan on Facebook. I'll be doing another show in a couple of minutes dealing with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. So you want to tune in for that. The call-in number is 6-929-0368, and I encourage you to call in, become a fan, follow on Twitter. Thank you so much for your support. You have a wonderful Saturday.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.